It's Friday, April 12th. Is there a lawmaker in the House? We start here. With abortion services hanging in the balance, Arizona Republicans leave the Capitol.
It is chaos and uncertainty.
Now a clinic backlog is creating a political backlash. Israel struck the Iranians, now the Middle East waits for a response.
Netanyahu appreciated the chance to take the war directly to Iran.
But could American troops be on the target list? And the argument hasn't changed since the Bronco hit the highway.
They were watching that verdict come in. And Black Americans applauded, and white Americans were shocked.
O.J. Simpson is dead, but the cultural divisions live on. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it exposed a lot of things. For one, it exposed anyone who had said, this is not something worth preparing for, it's not a real possibility. Well, some states immediately started criminalizing abortion services. But it also exposed states that, in all these years, since the 1970s, had never actually gone ahead and formalized abortion rights in their state laws. All their rules had been predicated on a federal policy that no longer existed. And some of these were states where the majority of voters clearly seemed to favor some sort of option for women, but whether because they hadn't thought it necessary or perhaps because they just found it politically risky, lawmakers had never actually held state-level votes guaranteeing access. Arizona was one of these states, which is why this week, when its state Supreme Court ruled that a 160-year-old abortion ban was the only applicable law on the books, everyone understood immediately how chaotic this was about to get. Well, now, state Democrats there are desperately trying to update the law, but they might be just a few days too late. ABC senior congressional correspondent Rachel Scott has traveled to Phoenix, Arizona. Rachel, what is it like right there? What have you been seeing?
It is chaos and uncertainty. That is what is playing out here in the state of Arizona. So yes, this ban has not gone into effect yet here in Arizona. But Brad, I have been in and out of some of these abortion clinics, speaking with abortion providers and doctors, and they tell me that this impact is already being felt.
Patients are sitting in our waiting room and they're reading the news media. And when they come into my office and I'm explaining to them the abortion procedure, they just have questions about how this could possibly be.
They have patients that are calling in. They're confused. They're asking if they're still providing abortion services. Some women have already started looking for other options and how to travel out of the state.
I'm not financially good enough to even take care of a child, and I can barely take care of myself at this point.
And Brad, I just talked to one patient here at a clinic in Phoenix. She came in for an abortion, and she broke down in tears.
Is this supposed to be a safe place for some? But no. It's most likely not anymore.
Telling me that the doctors told her she's probably one of the last women in Arizona to actually get an abortion at this clinic.
Well, so then what's happening with the law? Because it's not as if everyone in Arizona, like even lawmakers, are saying we should probably adjust this. It's from the 1860s. What are we doing?
Yeah, Brad, and that is what is particularly confusing about this for a lot of abortion providers in this state, because almost immediately after the Supreme Court ruled that this law could go into effect, we heard bipartisan outrage.
Should the 1864 ban on abortion remain the law in Arizona? People will die.
Democrats and Republicans here in Arizona were demanding that this law be repealed. Mm. Both sides were pointing out here that this is a law that was passed during the Civil War, before Arizona was even a state, and before women even had the right to vote.
No more speakers allowed. Please vote.
And so then we saw the state lawmakers come in and Democrats tried to move on to vote on a bill that would repeal this law, do exactly what Democrats and Republicans said they wanted to do.
The House will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 17th, 2024.
Well, Republicans just flat out blocked that effort, and then they left town. So they're not coming back to the state capitol until next Wednesday, Brad.
Wait, so what is the plan from these Republican lawmakers then?
They say they want to review this ruling, that it just came down and there's no need to sort of rush and try to pass things very quickly.
And Arizonans deserve to see their elected officials work on this matter, not adjourn, to delay the inevitable.
There is no reason to rush on this very important topic.
Well, I can tell you that a lot of these abortion providers and the women that are seeking abortions in this state concerned about the issue, they say there is an extreme sense of urgency here to get this done.
Wait, so then this will go into effect, you're saying? I think it had like 14 days before it went into effect. So that could pass, right?
Yeah, look, Brad, the best chances of abortion staying somewhat legal in this state is for the state lawmakers to move and act on a bill. But the state Supreme Court put this ruling on hold for 14 days.
This Supreme Court in Arizona just put Arizona women's lives in danger.
And I just spoke with the Arizona State Attorney General. She told me that because of a separate lawsuit, she believes that this ban will not go into effect for an additional 45 days. So it essentially buys them a little bit more time, but not much.
I have oaths to my patients that I will uphold. I also have oaths and responsibilities to my family. So I plan to follow the law.
Because there is so much confusion and uncertainty around this, abortion providers here in the state, they are not promising to continue to provide those services after that 14-day window. So we could see abortion services severely limited regardless.
So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about asking doctors to send women out to the parking lot and wait until they're almost dead before the doctor can provide care?
Another thing that the state attorney general told me, Brad, is that she actually acknowledged that while she won't enforce the law, she concedes that she can't stop local prosecutors from trying to go after some of these abortion providers. And she also raised this point of what happens after she potentially leaves. If there's a Republican state attorney general that comes in, that could totally shift the dynamics in this state as well.
All of the women who are pregnant now or who are about to become pregnant have to think about this new law.
She delivered a very stark and stern message urging Arizonans who are pregnant to sort of make a plan, telling them that they need to start considering other options. And because of that, Brad, we are starting to see the political pressure on Republicans grow. You have Senate candidates like Carrie Lake. Months ago, she came out in support of this 1864 ban. Well, now she is urging state lawmakers to do something different. She says this is completely out of step with Republicans. And then, of course, you have former President Donald Trump. Remember, he appointed three of the Supreme Court justices who supported overturning Roe versus Wade. That laid the groundwork for the sort of bans that we are seeing play out right now in the state of Arizona. Well, he now says that Arizona went too far, Brad.
Wow. Again, to see sort of the back and forth from Republicans here, but then to know that Republicans have left town, they've left the state capitol, and nothing is going to change, at least in the next few days, leaves a lot of women in Arizona very unsure. Okay, Rachel Scott there in Phoenix, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, from Tehran to Tel Aviv to Washington, D.C., everyone's getting ready for the worst. We'll explain. We're back in a bit. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We spent much of the last week describing the reactions to a controversial Israeli airstrike that killed food aid workers. But that's not even the only airstrike that could have wide-ranging implications for this war, because last weekend, Israel also appeared to launch an airstrike in Syria against a consular building belonging to Iran.
Iran claiming it was an Israeli airstrike that reduced its consulate building to rubble in Damascus, Syria, killing 2 top Iranian military commanders.
Since then, everyone is wondering if Iran might strike back, and American government officials are saying the U.S. might not be out of the woods either. Colonel Stephen Ganyard is a former Marine and State Department official. He's now an ABC News contributor. Colonel Ganyard, first of all, what do we know about this strike apparently launched by Israel? They haven't copped to it, but everyone seems to be on the same page. This was them.
Well, I think, Brad, one of the things that's most interesting to me is that they struck the consulate, and the consulate was right next door to the embassy, and embassies are considered sovereign territory. So, in effect, the Israelis hit Iran directly. Now, they have never done that or never done that and publicly admitted it. So this is a new phase of their war with Iran, and that's what it's been. It's been a low-key war, but it's a war that the Iranians have been waging with proxies. So think of the 4 H's, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. Mm. So that's how Iran is able to punch way above its weight, by using other people, making other people die for their cause, using their money and their weapons. So the thing that's most interesting about Damascus is the Israelis were basically dropping the gloves and say, let's go, Iran. Mm. This isn't on your territory, but it's time to go head to head. And so what the Iranians come back with is the real question. Do they use their proxies, or do they take it at face value and come back at Israel directly?
Well, and so then the news in the most recent days is the U.S. basically warning Israel, being like, we think Iran is probably about to hit back. I mean, what form would that take? And does that launch an even bigger sort of back and forth?
Well, this is what's so concerning, because if it really does come to that, the Israelis are far more capable than the Iranians are in terms of projecting power. Remember that, as far as we know, the Iranians don't have a nuclear weapon. The Israelis do. Mm. The Iranians are working on ways to get nuclear weapons as far as Israel. We know Israel does have the capability to put nuclear weapons into Iran. So we're really teetering on a bit of an edge here to make sure that this doesn't come directly to blows between Iran and Israel, because Israel will use it as an excuse to do some of the things that they've been wanting to do for a long time.
It is a battle for our future. But it's also the battle for the victory of the Israel-American moderate Arab axis against the Iran axis.
So whatever the Israelis do, if they do something against Iran, it will probably either be against regime targets, targeting the leadership, or something against an economic target.
Our commitment to Israel's security against these threats from Iran and its proxies is ironclad. Let me say it again, ironclad.
It's very, very scary here. If this comes down to it, the U.S. is going to be in the middle, because we have ships in the Red Sea. Theoretically, if Iran shoots cruise missiles at Israel, the U.S. ships and the coalition ships that are in the Red Sea might be able to take down some of them. But the long-range ballistic missiles will rely on the Israeli defenses. It would be a big test for the Israeli layered defense system. And where it goes from there is hard to say, because Netanyahu appreciated the chance to take the war directly to Iran.
Well, and which brings us to threats against even non-service member Americans, right? In recent days, the U.S. government has told Americans in and around Israel, you know, don't travel, you know, you could be at risk. Back in the U.S., you've got authorities worried about potential terror attacks from groups like ISIS-K, the group that hit Russia a few weeks ago. And then there's potential just lone wolf terror attacks. I mean, what are authorities sort of most concerned about, or is it just everything?
Well, you think there are homegrown threats, then there's ISIS-K. ISIS-K is rejuvenating in the areas of Afghanistan that we left. It's not quite ISIS, but it does have the same sort of global ambitions. But back home, oftentimes we see that international movements get lone wolf attraction. So sometimes lonely people who have disturbed visions of what the world ought to be are able to latch on to something like ISIS-K and say, I find justification here. I find rationalization. That's been the real threat in the U.S. lately, is this homegrown threat that we worry about back here at home, even more than we do than sort of organized terrorist threats the way ISIS-K would like to come to the U.S.
Which is interesting right now that you have all these different groups basically saying, be on the lookout. You got the Pentagon saying Israel should be on the lookout for Iran, Homeland Security saying be on the lookout for ISIS-K attacks here in the States, and then the FBI saying also sort of these lone wolf attacks that you're describing. All right, Stephen Ganyard, in an uneasy moment around the world, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brett.
You probably heard that O.J. Simpson died yesterday at the age of 76, which might mean different things to different people. To our younger listeners, he might be seen as an oddity at this point, a guy who evaded a murder rap only to end up stealing memorabilia and going to prison for that. To some folks who watched him back in the day, he'll always be the star athlete whose magnetism helped him achieve icon status. But to much of the country, O.J. Simpson will forever be the man who sparked passionate, heated debates about the criminal justice system in this country, race relations, and, of course, the double murder for which he was found liable in a civil trial but was never convicted criminally. Let's go to ABC's chief national correspondent, Matt Gutman, who's based in Los Angeles. Matt, first off, what do we know about O.J. Simpson's death? Was this unexpected?
His family said he died of cancer. It's been reported it was prostate cancer. They said he died surrounded by his children and his grandchildren. Just a couple of months ago, Brad, during the Super Bowl, he posted a video talking about his illness and saying that he's on the mend. He'll be back on the golf course soon. And obviously, that was not the case.
Yeah, how will he be remembered? This is a complicated question, but how will he be remembered?
At his peak, OJ would describe himself, Brad, to his friends as, I'm not black, I'm OJ.
After school, I want to play at least 5 years. I think that's when the pension comes in. Then after that.
And he was this sort of separate species, this incredible icon, first on the field. He was a Heisman Trophy winner at USC.
First down and more. There's Simpson. Look at that cut. O.J. Simpson.
Blazing speed, really big, very strong, shedding tackles, swiveling hips. Then he played 11 years in the NFL.
O.J. Simpson breaking through.
Went to the Pro Bowl, was all NFL, set the record for most yards running as a running back. The guy was a dynamo on the field, and he was handsome, and he was charming, and he had this megawatt smile. And even as he was a player, he was doing color commentary. And even then, he started taking jobs as an actor.
Norberg! Hiya, buddy! Hey! Doc says I should be on my bean, and as good as new in a week.
And as a pitch man, hurdling these benches. I remember this so vividly, Brad, as a kid, watching him do these Hertz commercials.
Take it from OJ. You don't get to be a superstar by just standing around.
He was so athletic, but also so charming. You could not like OJ Simpson. And that was his brand, this immense, radiant likability.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report from Eyewitness News.
And then that likability gets turned 180 degrees. We hear in 1994, on June 12th, that his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman, were slaughtered in their house, and he is the prime suspect.
According to law enforcement officials, they are pursuing a vehicle in which they believe O.J. Simpson is a passenger.
The whole nation, 95 million people, watching this slow speed chase, that white Bronco just moseying along down L.A. freeways, followed by police. He eventually went home and turned himself in. That was the start of this nine-month-long trial, this mega trial, trial of the century, whatever you want to call it. For those who watched it, and so many people did, gavel to gavel, it was unforgettable.
Yeah, live trial, by the way, which in those days, like, this is the first time TV had showed this sort of thing. I'm wondering, what did that whole process, all the way to his not guilty verdict, I mean, what did that, less about him even, what did that reveal about our culture?
It revealed so much about our culture, our justice system, and Los Angeles at that point in time. Remember, Brad, that this came after the LAPD was filmed beating Rodney King, after the riots in Los Angeles where so many fires were set and people were killed. There was real racial tension in this city, and a lot of the fingers were pointed at the LAPD, which was the investigative body that did all the work on the O.J. Simpson case.
Try to convict the man because he's black. Go find a real killer.
They get pulled into the trial, and lo and behold, find out that some of the people who are on the case are in fact racists, and they're saying things about O.J. Simpson. And so, yes, it was a trial, and yes, the defense did a brilliant job.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
And yes, there were some major mistakes made by the prosecution, but you can't discount the racial undertones that were present through the entirety of that 9+ month spectacle at the courthouse in downtown L.A.
Yeah, and so O.J. Simpson found, again, criminally not guilty, even though prosecutors said they had his DNA at the murder scene. He was later found civilly liable for all of that. But, I mean, as you describe the issues at play, it's not like a ton of this mistrust with police, with black and brown Americans has gone away. I mean, have there been lessons to be drawn from his life now that he's dead?
No, I think that mistrust remains, but I think the awareness nationally has increased tremendously. You know, there was this moment on the Oprah Winfrey Show when they were watching that verdict come
we
in.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of...
And black Americans applauded and white Americans were shocked.
Some justice to the black community! Some justice to the black community for the black!
That totally makes me mad because he paid his way through the trial.
Obviously, O.J. Simpson, in my belief, is not a moral person. Some injustice has been done today.
And it not only revealed this racial divide, but it also revealed, I think, to many Americans how broken in many ways the justice system was, how unjust it was if you were black or brown. And it was the continuation of this arc from the civil rights movement through that trial, through the Trayvon Martin shooting, in which we saw the racial inequalities in the justice system. And slowly and surely, I think they are getting better. But that was a major, major inflection point.
Yeah, it was almost as if you'd have people watching it side by side, and at the end they would turn to each other and go, wait, so he's innocent, right? Or what do you mean? No, of course he's guilty. Like, it was that kind of seeing through the looking glass of how the rest of America was experiencing it. That was almost the lesson. That was the takeaway for so many people, even as Simpson was acquitted. And now these conversations continuing will continue after his death. Matt Gutman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, if I don't want an entire gold bar, could I maybe just get a lady in a hairnet to offer me a sample? We go Costco shopping after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. I am a child of Costco. I grew up going there for pallets worth of groceries with my family, buckets of laundry detergent, and of course, the samples topped off by a hot dog for $1.50. And even though you could get everything there, including big screen TVs, I never had gold bars on my grocery list.
The big box store leaning into the trend of collecting gold and silver as they become more valuable.
Last year, Costco began selling gold bullion, 1-ounce bars from Switzerland, which sounds absurd because usually if you're investing in gold, you might go through a financial service company or a gold trader, not your big box store. These are now retailing for more than $2,000. But in recent days, Wells Fargo wrote a note to investors saying that Costco's gold business is exploding to the tune of up to 200 $100 million a month. Part of that almost certainly has to do with inflation. When paper money feels like it's losing value, consumers often see precious metals as more consistent. Then there's the discount factor. Costco usually sells these bars for 2% above market price, but experts say members can recoup some of that markup.
The actual price of the bars are a little bit more expensive than what is being offered in the regular market, but exclusive members are able to get about 3% back on that purchase.
But perhaps more significantly, this has also become something of a meme, a frenzy. People aren't just buying gold for value, they're buying it for fun.
Wow, the gold bar.
This is Humphrey Yang, a personal finance content creator, perfect indicator of where we are at in 2024, who says he bought a gold bar when he was on a churro run at Costco.
So we get over there to the food court. There's no churro, but there were gold bars in stock.
Look at this. 1 ounce of fine gold. And certificate number two.
Folks like Humphrey are buying these bars and posting them on social media, which then convinces more people to snag one for themselves.
We're getting married this year, so I figured it was a sign that we should definitely buy it.
We just wanted to kind of dive in and keep our eggs in a different basket.
However, even if this seems like a pretty risk-free investment, financial experts say it's not the best one. For one thing, while it's easy to buy gold, it can be tough to sell at a fair price. Then there's the illusion of value. In the last 10 years, the price of gold has risen 76%, which sounds great, until you realize that the S&P 500 stock index has risen almost 200%. That's money that you wouldn't have gotten if you had bought a few bars of gold. If you're really looking to save money at Costco, it might be wiser to make your shopping cart an ounce lighter. I also just love picturing the dude who is highlighting the receipts on the way out. Like, yep, there's your huge muffins, there's your 75 rolls of toilet paper, and your gold. Okay, good to go. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas Baker, Vika Aronson, Cameron Chertavian, Anthony Ali, Mara Milwaukee, and Amira Williams. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. I'm our managing editor. Laura Mayer is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Tara Gimbel, and Liz Alessi. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Jeff Cook, Kate Shaw, the team at Nat Geo, and really the whole team across the country who helped us experience that eclipse. I'm still buzzing. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.